The Science Show on RN, where we turn to some even further reaching monitoring, to Pluto and beyond. Remember those wonderful pictures of the dwarf planet? Alan Stern from New Horizons led the team that produced one of the most successful missions ever. As Jonathan Webb remarks, they even found Pluto has a heart.
Even looking from afar, there were hints that it was going to be exciting. Like you say, it has a brand, but now it has an icon as well, right? Because suddenly we had a picture with a heart on it. Suddenly our understanding totally changed in technicolor detail.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it could have been the Jolly Roger or something. It turned out to be a heart. It was spectacular.
A little planet with a heart, but we won't touch on that, whether astronomers think it's a planet or not.
Oh, but the astronomers are the guys that are expert in black holes and not planets. You should listen to planetary scientists.
And I've got a great one in the room, so I will. But of all the things that did blow our minds about it, mountains of ice and glaciers of nitrogen and a heart-shaped expanse, extra moons, I think, were discovered as part of the trip. What was the thing that you never even expected?
I would say that the biggest single surprise is the wide variety of activity taking place on a massive scale across Pluto itself. From flowing glaciers to avalanches to clouds, young volcanoes the size of Mauna Loa, and more, all in that one little place, the size of Australia. Sometimes we have an acronym for Pluto. It's SOFI, something for everyone.
That's nice. I would agree. When you talk about it being active, that's geological activity, right? It's not a barren, rocky, icy world. It is certainly icy, but there's all sorts of stuff going on, which, is totally jaw-dropping.
Yeah. Second to the Earth and Mars, it is the belle of the ball. It is as active as we've ever seen. We've seen so many frozen, dead worlds that died billions of years ago, and they're still scientifically fascinating and a lot to teach us. And we've seen worlds that have gone haywire, like Mars and Venus, that can teach us about climate change and how you better take it seriously. But then we went to Pluto and we're just stunned that a little place so far away and so cold, just 40 degrees above absolute zero, could be so active so long after its birth and on such a massive scale. We're still scratching our heads.
And will there be more surprises to come? Because the data only comes down pretty slowly from that little probe that's now way out beyond Pluto. I remember hearing at the time the drip feed of data is about like an old dial-up modem, right? From the 90s.
Exactly that. We have all the data on the ground now. Okay. Now, we finished the tail end of last year. But there's a massive job of coming to understand it all and put all the pieces together. In fact, there's a growing recognition that just like the first flybys of Mars, we really need to go back next with an orbiter, much more sophisticated instrument payload, and there to stay.
But in the meantime, New Horizons has got another target, right? The little probe after how many miles now? Billions?
Yeah, I think we've got about 4 billion miles on the odometer.
4 billion on the clock, and it's going further out into the Kuiper Belt, and you've picked a new target.
Yes, we are on our way to a flyby of a very interesting small Kuiper Belt object, only about 30 kilometers across, one of the building blocks of planets like Pluto. So we're going to learn about how Pluto and its brethren like Eris and Makemake and Haumea and Ixion were formed. No one's ever been to a world like this. It's about 1,000 times the mass of a typical comet, and about 10,000 times less massive than Pluto. So it sits right in the middle logarithmically.
And what's it called?
Well, it's only got a license plate so far. We found it in 2014 with the Hubble Space Telescope. It's called 2014 MU69. If that doesn't quite roll off your tongue, we'll fix that for you. We're going to have a public naming contest partnering with NASA. And we hope to announce a new name at the beginning of next year, exactly a year before the flyby, which will be on January 1st. 2019.
That's a big New Year's Eve for you guys.
Yes, and everyone else can come along as well and spend your New Year's Eve with NASA. Yeah. Spend your Christmas in the Kuiper Belt.
Very, very exciting times. And that object you've been studying and trying to figure out more while New Horizons is covering the distance to get there, we're trying to figure out what you might expect, right? And I gather there was a study of that object that you did from the telescope on a plane from the SOFIA Observatory over the Pacific.
Yeah, we have a very powerful technique in which we can watch the target, MU69, pass in front of a star and make it wink out. And from the amount of time that it winks out, you can tell how big it is if you know the orbital speed, which we do. If you watch it wink out from multiple telescopes in slightly different places with different lines of sight, you can trace out its shape. We were looking for debris around it, and SOFIA showed us that there's not any significant debris. SOFIA is the NASA Airborne Observatory with a telescope the size of the Hubble in it.
Yeah, a 747 with a hole in the side and a telescope peering out. It's an
exactly.
amazing thing.
So, yeah, so I flew on that mission on July the 10th out of Christchurch, New Zealand, north to Tahiti where the shadow crossed and then back. And then a week later, we had 24 telescopes arrayed in a north-south picket fence line in Patagonia. For a similar event, five of the telescopes were able to spy the star winking out. And from that, we have learned and just announced that MU69 looks to be a double, a binary.
There's two of it.
Yeah, the two may be touching, or they may just be projected in front of each other and actually orbiting like a binary pair. And we'll have to wait the flyby in 17 months' time to really know, but we will have spectacular imagery because we're going closer than we went to Pluto.
Yeah, and we saw those images. They were crystal clear. But that's quite an effort to chase essentially the shadow of this tiny object cast by a star a long way away, so a very, very faint shadow. But to be able to chase that in a plane across the Pacific must have been quite exciting.
Well, the pilots did a spectacular job. They put us within 1 kilometer of the right place and within 1 second of the appointed time.
Amazing.
With a big airplane. It's not very maneuverable. They did a great job.
And so there's two lumps of something. What's that something going to be? Is it sort of dust and ice all clumped together? What are we expecting?
Well, why don't you ask me in 17 months? No one's ever been to one of these things. I don't like to make predictions because you usually end up being wrong. Nature's always richer expressions than looking at a point of light in the distance 4.5 billion miles away. It's hard to tell what it's made of.
Of course, but based on things we've seen that are closer, like a comet, which we got famously close to with the European Rosetta mission, was kind of dusty and icy, and that's what we think of when we think of something that's only that small. Is it likely to be similar, or do you genuinely have no idea what to expect?
Well, there's a conventional notion that rocks run into each other and build boulders, and boulders run into each other and build comets, and comets run into each other, and they make MU69s and planets. So, again, this is 1,000 times the mass of the comet that Rosetta orbited. That means it's massive enough that it probably have active surface geology at some point in its past. And we've never been to something of that size that's been in this deep freeze all along. So we're just going to have to see. The thing about New Horizons is you got to really love delayed gratification on this mission.
Well, 9 years to get to Pluto was enough of a wait. And then another few to get to MU69. Is there anything after that? How much fuel's left in the tank and how much longer can New Horizons keep dripping results back here to Earth?
Well, we hope to be a fire hose of results, actually. We use our telescopes all the time to study other Kuiper Belt objects that we pass by in the distance. And so we're actually making observations that you can't make from the Earth, you can't make from the Hubble, because we're there. We are an observatory in the Kuiper Belt, and we'll be there for at least 5 more years and maybe even 10, because we don't know how far out the Kuiper Belt goes. The spacecraft's in perfect health. It has a lot of backup systems. We're not using any of them. We have power to run the systems on board into the 2030s, so 20 years from now. We have fuel to do the same. We have communications capability to operate a spacecraft even much farther out than it will be in the 2030s. So there's every prospect that this mission, if it's funded to continue, will produce spectacular results all across the 2020s and much or maybe all the 2030s.
Wow, that's impressive. And when you talk about how much fuel you've got left, that's what allows you to actually change direction and target something new. Are there limits on how much fuel you can spend and what sort of maneuvers you can turn? Would you be able to do a full U-turn and come back closer again, or is that going to burn too much?
Yeah, we're traveling on a one-way exit of the solar system at a speed of about 50,000 kilometers per hour.
Kind of fast.
Yeah, super fast. And we only have a little bit of fuel on board that allows us to target new flybys if we find something interesting, or to use it with our control jets just to point the telescopes day in and day out. And we have to divide the remaining fuel between those two priorities. So we're now looking for another flyby target. We'll see if we find something. If we don't, we'll use it as an observatory. And if we do, we'll go there.
So you're choosing between small adjustments you can make to fly by other interesting things on your way out. It's not about zipping around the Kuiper Belt and choosing absolutely anything that you would really like to study.
New Horizons is a very sophisticated machine, but it is not the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah. So the fuel, which allows it, I guess, to actually change direction, and then a nuclear power source, which is running the instruments. And that's the thing, you say you've got power to run right through till the 2030s.
That's right. The nuclear power supply on board runs the radios, the computers, the guidance systems, the star trackers, the scientific instruments, the heaters, all of it. And every year, because of the radioactive decay of the plutonium inside, it produces about 3 less watts. We started off with 250. We're at about 195 now, a dozen years after launch. And there'll come a point when there's just not enough wattage to run the main radio and main computer and do any more science. But again, that's probably 2 decades off.
Fascinating. Given the current climate in the US, what do you think would be the likelihood of getting another mission? You said there's a lot more to find out from New Horizons, but really you'd love to go back to Pluto, send something into orbit maybe. What's the likelihood of that to happen?
Well, you know, one thing that we learned from New Horizons is there's a lot more to learn about the Pluto system and that we need an orbiter to do that. We've also learned that the other planets of the Kuiper Belt deserve exploration. They're as diverse a population as the terrestrial planets, Earth, Mars, Venus, and Mercury. And so I think in both cases, there's plenty of room for more missions. In the United States, you make that scientific case to the National Academy of Sciences. They rank up all the good proposals. The ones at the very top get funded. And both our Congress and recent administrations have been very supportive of planetary exploration. They do inspire, and they do produce good results. And frankly, they send a lot of children to go off to STEM careers, which we need to fuel the economy. So I'm pretty optimistic, and I'm taking the long view that we will go back to Pluto in the Kuiper Belt, and we will go to study the ocean worlds of our solar system, and we will send humans to Mars. I think all that is in the near future. I'm excited about it.
Optimism is good. Finally, we have one question from a young friend of the show who accompanied our producer, David Fisher, to your talk, which is about the journey, about getting from here out to Pluto, which is obviously an immense journey and relies on getting a good boost from the gravitational heavyweight of the solar system from Jupiter, right? And I gather the launch window was pretty tightly calculated, partly because Pluto needed to be in a good accessible position, but also Jupiter is really important to get that boost. And it took you 9 years to get there. But if you hadn't had that boost, if Jupiter hadn't been in the right place, how much time would that add? Just how important is that kind of slingshot maneuver that we hear about?
Yeah, we really wanted that slingshot because it cut the journey from 13.7 years to 9.5, which meant the spacecraft had a much greater chance of surviving the journey. The power supply was producing more watts, so we could turn on more instruments than we would have after 14 years. We had more fuel on board. The communications range was better. So everything was working in our favor if we could get that Jupiter flyby, which we did. And then, and I'll say this, and I get goosebumps every time I said it, the team that produced New Horizons conducted the farthest exploration in the history of our species. I can't believe we really did it.
Yes, they did it. Alan Stern from New Horizons with Jonathan Webb.